KALW.
We're not starting at a starting point that was initiated with George Floyd or on Juneteenth. We were really going back 157 years and trying to pick up where good people left off.
Santa Clara County passed a resolution declaring that racism is a public health crisis. What does that mean for the county?
Reparations. I think it's going to take massive public safety reconstruction. You know, it's just going to mean a lot of willingness to reject the way we've done things in the past.
We hear from the author of the resolution. Then bookshop owners around the Bay Area rally to save their beloved independence.
I guess we're symbolic of civilization not falling to pieces. That feels kind of good that people think that.
That's coming up. I'm Henat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. The recent protests against the killing of Black people by police have put racial inequity at the forefront of our national conversation. Companies and organizations are addressing race and diversity in their ranks. Even for us in journalism, newsrooms and journalism schools are reflecting on how they cover race and how diverse their staffs are. Santa Clara County witnessed some of the first and largest protests in the Bay Area last month in San Jose. And one thing the Santa Clara County Board of Supervisors has done is promise to address inequity in their county. On June 23rd, the supervisors unanimously adopted a resolution declaring racism a public health crisis. So what does that exactly mean in terms of policy, and how do statements of support like that translate to actual change on the ground? I called up the author of that resolution, Supervisor Dave Cortese, and put those questions to him. There have been resolutions in the past. There have been kind of symbolic gestures made by government, whether local or state or national. And people always wonder, okay, you know, this is beautiful. What does it really mean? In thinking about this resolution, how did you think about that?
I was quite aware of that, you know, that's both syndrome, the syndrome where, you know, things dissipate, energy dissipates, resolutions become worthless pieces of paper because action isn't taken. I won't say that Santa Clara County is exempt from that. Certainly we've had powerful resolutions that we have then acted upon and, again, been leaders in the nation in certain areas, around immigration, for example. But we've also, like a lot of local governments and other levels of government, tried to, you know, step into an important issue and then just not been able to carry the bureaucracy along with us, not been able to effectuate change. When we rolled this out, I described it as that kind of a new beginning, that we need to once again, you know, we're not starting at a starting point that was initiated with George Floyd or on Juneteenth or at the June 23rd board meeting when we adopted it, that we were really going back 157 years and trying to pick up where good people left off and try to make things right. And that's going to take a lot of work beyond just what I'm calling reconstruction and reconciliation. I think it's going to take reparations. I think it's going to take massive public safety reconstruction, getting cops out of the business of responding to, you know, people who look like a DUI suspect in a private parking lot or mental health cases or homelessness cases. You know, it's just going to mean a lot of willingness to reject or to not accept the way we've done things in the past.
And if we take a look at some of the things in the resolution, promoting community engagement and engaging authentically with communities of color, incorporating educational efforts to understand how racism affects individual and population health, committing to reviewing all portions of ordinances, codified ordinances, with a racial equity lens. And this term racial equity lens comes up a lot. in the resolution in regards to a number of things. So I'm wondering whose perspective will define the lens and how will that work be done?
I believe that what's been going on in this country through my lifetime, and I'm 64 years old, and I think for a long time before I was born, is an attitude which is mixed in there with what we call white privilege. But we have, you know, this thing, maybe it's that same group that Ronald Reagan called the silent majority, you know, that's shouldn't they be satisfied by now? Haven't we created enough equity, enough opportunity? And the answer is no, not even close. That's even the attitude is not even close. Today is the resolution to finally get that done in our county. And I think if you knit this kind of resolve together, county by county, city by city across the country, it doesn't really matter what the United States Senate does. If we can make that shift, you know, in our own local jurisdictions.
Some of the other things, just going through the resolution, training elected officials on workplace bias, also promoting policies that prioritize the health of people of color and mitigating exposure to ACEs, adverse childhood experiences in childhood. I'm wondering, all of this needs money. When it comes to, you know, setting the new budget, how high up the priority list will these things be when it comes to funding?
Well, I don't know if it's true or not, but I've often heard that the Chinese character for crisis is the same as for opportunity. And you have to look at it that way. And as an elected official who has been, you know, in office during significant ups and downs, it is often when systems are being torn down, when budgets are being reduced, when concessions in budgets are being made by department heads, when positions are being frozen, where you do get a fresh start. Because essentially, you know, one way to look at this is the pandemic has stopped us in our tracks. And that's not a bad thing in this context, in the context of racial equity. We needed to be stopped in our tracks. You know, the graphic images of George Floyd stopped us in our tracks and launched a movement. The pandemic, meanwhile, stopped us economically in our tracks. And government is going to have to reimagine, reinvent itself. And while that's happening, what better, you know, underpinning to deal with than structural or institutional racism within your own government? So it is an opportunity, and I know you're asking a more specific question. Yeah, but still, you need money. But money gets shifted, money gets moved around, money gets reappropriated just as much in tough times as it does, you know, in times of great wealth and great revenue.
How will you measure the success of this resolution? You mentioned you have the support of the NAACP, of San Jose Silicon Valley, the Black Kitchen Cabinet, Silicon Valley Debug. They've all supported the resolution, but they also, you know, they vowed to hold the county accountable, as you are welcoming. How do you measure success? What's that like?
You know, I do think we have a responsibility as a board of supervisors to make sure that we're literally that we're putting measurements in place, and that we're getting reports back, and that we're holding our own administration accountable. And there's ways to do that. And I'll tell you one of those ways. Every single item on our board of supervisors agenda, at the end of the legislative file, it has a question. What is the fiscal impact? And then it's answered. Oh, this item's going to cost $1 million. Or this item has no fiscal impact. We're just shifting money from one department to another. And what we need to do is start putting an equity impact statement on every one of those same items. Every vote the Board of Supervisors takes, I believe, should not just have fiscal impact analyzed, or stated in analytical terms, but it should also have the impact on racial equity, racial and ethnic equity impact statement on it as well. And then it takes the Board of Supervisors to make sure that's a real statement, a legitimate statement, that somebody didn't just go through the motions and say, this meets our requirements for resolving racism in our county. No. It's got to say in real terms what's going to change or not. And I think that's the kind of work, you know, it's not that complicated. Force yourself, force those that follow you to answer that question every time they cast a vote. And we have a chance. We have a fighting chance.
Dave Cortese is a Santa Clara County supervisor and author of an adopted resolution that declared racism a public health crisis. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Independent bookstores around the country are hurting right now. Nationally, bookstore sales in April were down more than 60%. A few weeks ago, University Press Books announced it would shut down for good after nearly 50 years in Berkeley. And local booksellers staying the course say it could take a while before sales return to a pre-pandemic pace. KALW's Holly J. McDeed reports on how the independent bookstores of the East Bay are turning to the community to hold on.
Doris Moskowitz runs Moe's Books, and she says customers sometimes tell her Berkeley wouldn't exist without Moe's. She thinks that's an exaggeration, but she knows Moe's is a landmark. It was founded in 1959 by Doris's mom, Barb, and dad, Moe.
He was a really, like, larger-than-life guy. When I was a kid, I was born in 1966, I definitely thought that he had read all these books, but...
That would be quite the feed. It's a huge shop, four floors stocked with hundreds of thousands of new, used, and rare books. Moe's has also been part of the fabric of Berkeley's culture. It became a refuge for people protesting the Vietnam War during the free speech movement of the 60s. Moe kept the store open during curfew, and protesters hid out in the shop as police fired tear gas on the city.
They were really comfortable just letting protesters come in the store to get away from the National Guard and get away from the gas. And, you know, then they were proud that rioters who maybe even didn't even know the store, they knew enough to respect it.
Moe's has spent the last few decades battling the wrath of the chain store, then Amazon, then the recession. Moskowitz says at the start of this year, it was beginning to finally feel like the golden age of independent bookstores again. Moe's was filled with customers. That is, until the Bay Area was ordered to stay at home.
But I was just so worried and so confused and so concerned about everything and everyone that I found myself up here working anyway. It's like other people are at home gardening and working on their house and doing puzzles, and I'm up here putting books away because I needed to be here.
Moskowitz says May sales at Moe's were down 70% compared to last year. Even though the store is open again, business is still hurting. That's true for a lot of bookstores right now. Author Charlie Jane Anders worries that when the pandemic is over, not all bookstores will make it to the other side.
I honestly really believe that the San Francisco Bay Area, without these local bookstores, will just become a soulless dystopia. And I know a lot of people feel like the Bay Area has already been at risk of losing its soul.
And has been losing pieces of its soul for a long time. So in an effort to slow down this soul demolition, Anders and others organized an event called We Love Bookstores. The idea is simple. The group hosts literary events online to fundraise for local bookstores.
You know, we tried to target the bookstores that we thought were at the most risk of having to close if we don't support them, and also at the most, you know, at the most kind of essential for their communities.
The We Love Bookstores team raised an average of almost $3,000 during each of their first 19 events. The funds have gone to bookstores like Moe's in Berkeley, Dog-Eared Books in San Francisco, and the Multicultural Children's Bookstore in Richmond. Tamara Shiloh runs the store. She's also the author of the children's book series, What If There Were No Black People in the World?
All right, don't panic. This is the name of my children's book series about African-American inventors and scientists.
The Multicultural Children's Bookstore is one of the few bookstores in Richmond.
I just like to stay in Richmond. It's where I live. It's where I grew up. It's home. And I want my bookstore to be in my home.
Before the shelter in place, Shiloh hosted Black history and science classes at the bookstore. She says you'd be hard-pressed to find a multicultural bookstore like it anywhere.
You know, we just want to make sure that we satisfy, take care of the community. So we try to make sure we accommodate as many folks as we can, if not all.
But when the shop shut during shelter in place, sales literally stopped. But that all changed when protests erupted a few weeks ago around the country after the killing of George Floyd. Shiloh tells me the orders are now pouring in. People are looking for books to help them make sense of racism in America. Adult books like White Fragility and children's books like The Anti-Racist Baby.
And it's a board book. It's for babies. It's been incredible. The number of people who are, you know, stepping up, realizing that they need to have a better understanding of what's going on, not so much what's going on, but why.
Other bookstores reached out directly to the community during shelter in place. Take Walden Pond Books, not too far from Oakland's Lake Merritt, for example. Walden Pond Books first opened in 1973 inside of a plant store, but soon the books outsold the plants, says manager Bob Fisher.
And our guiding principle is getting the right book to the right person at the right time. I can't think of one category of book that we don't carry. Oh, I can think of something. Computer books.
But when people can't come into the shop, it's hard to help people find books. About 12 weeks ago, Fisher says the shop was at risk of folding for good. They began using Bookshop, a new website that helps indie storefronts sell books online.
And it's basically the independent bookstore's answer to Amazon. It's an interface that allows booksellers to make lists of books they recommend, and we can sell them online extremely easily.
And in what Fisher calls reluctant desperation, Walden Pond Books launched a GoFundMe campaign.
And the results really exceeded our expectations. We raised over $100,000 in 10 days.
And some of the comments on the GoFundMe page had him tearing up.
The ones I remember especially are the ones from people who said they literally grew up at Walden Pond Books. Walden Pond Books was the first time that they had held a book in their hand. That's where they discovered books. That's where they discovered they loved books. People just don't want us to go away.
That combination of sleek internet platform and customers unwilling to see this physical space go saved the bookstore. Walden Pond Books is no longer at risk of closing for good, though its doors are still shut for now. But slowly, the Bay Area's bookstore ecosystem is beginning to awaken. Across the Bay, City Lights in North Beach and Green Apple Books in the Richmond District are open again. And in Berkeley, just weeks ago, Moe's opened its doors.
And everyone that came in was so happy. Oh gosh, they were so happy. It was so great.
Owner Doris Moskowitz says many of the regulars were back, and they wandered over to their usual spots. People have been stuck in their homes for so long, Moskowitz says, that to be in a bookstore again can feel like exploring the entire world. People wear face coverings and stand 6 feet apart. Staff also count customers to make sure not too many people are inside at one time.
They come to the door and they take a big, deep breath. And they, I mean, they're wearing a mask, but they take a breath and they'd say, okay, everything's going to be okay.
I guess we're symbolic of civilization not falling to pieces. So that feels kind of good that people think that. I don't know if it's true. It's true to me.
Moskowitz says most of the shop sales are still online, and it's likely to be like that for a while. But she's optimistic that even if all else feels like it's crumbling, even if sales are down for now, this bookstore isn't going anywhere. In Berkeley, I'm Holly Dimmick-Deed for Cross Currents.
Holly.
Kelly is KALW's justice reporter. Find more of her stories at KALW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Bay Area authors have had to cancel launch parties and book tours because of the coronavirus. So we're bringing them to you in this series we're calling New Arrivals. Today we hear from Sacramento author Shelley Blanton Stroud, reading from her new novel, Copy Boy. It's set in 1930s San Francisco. Here's Shelley.
It's about a girl, Jane, in 1937. Who runs away from the Sacramento tomato fields off to the city, where she turns herself into a boy to escape her mama and daddy and the crimes she may or may not have committed against them. In this scene, Jane learns why her parents fight. Watching your daddy out on the baseball field, mama sighed, shook her head. I could see he was playing like he was, just for me. Something charged straight through me. She kneaded the skin over her heart. Your daddy had a certain kind of power. Jane thought, still has it. Wasn't no stopping it. We made you and your brother, God's greatest blessings, no matter I was just the age you are now. Mama had delivered two babies, buried one, when she was just 15. But you know what, Jane? Your daddy don't have that power over me no more. Power I need now? Electricity. I want a man who can turn on the lights. That wasn't daddy.
That was author Shelley Blanton Stroud reading from her new novel, Copy Boy. You can find more information about that book and others at KALW.org/newarrivals. Today's Cross Currents team includes Christopher Agusa, Imran Ali Malik, Lisa Morehouse, True Gwynn, Marissa Ortega Welch, and Babette Thomas. Our engineers are Tariq Foda and Gabe Graben. Production manager is Shireen Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.